Good morning and welcome back to the Word for Life radio ministry. Last couple of times we've been together, we've been focusing our attention on the true stories of the pilgrims who arrived in our country to find religious freedom. Our stories today are taken from a book entitled Thanksgiving, A Time to Remember by Barbara Rainey. Last time we ended off the story of them finally reaching land, but not getting off the ship and beginning to build their homes because the next day was a Sabbath. And so they spent the day in prayer, meditation, reading psalms, singing, and praising God. Then, in the days that followed, several expeditions were made to explore the area to seek the best location for a settlement. Now, winter weather was now about to make this effort more miserable. The pilgrim men and sailors who chose to go along endured freezing rain and rough waves as they rowed across the bay. One day they met Indians on shore without any incident, but the next day they were attacked. And though many arrows were shot at the men and the musket fire was returned, nobody was injured. Again the pilgrims gave thanks to God for His protection and deliverance. They called the place First Encounter, as it is still called to this day. In spite of these difficulties, the men were successful, having slowly made their way by land and by sea around the interior of the Cape. They eventually found an ideal spot on the mainland. And what an ideal spot it was. The land was fertile, four spring-fed creeks, and a large section of ground already cleared and ready for planting. The men rejoiced at their discovery. Now, during their explorations, many colonists back on board the Mayflower became gravely ill, and a few died, including William Bradford's young wife, Dorothy. It was little time for mourning and sadness. Their desperate condition demanded they all work, especially the men, to establish the colony. But it wasn't until December 11th, a month after they had first dropped anchor, that a landing was made at what was to become the permanent settlement. Plans had been made to first build a meeting house and then 19 family dwellings, the unmarried men having been assigned to live with families. These buildings were to be simple one-room frame houses, about 18 by 14 feet in size, with a fireplace and a sleeping loft. There was no glass in the windows, and the roofs were made of thatch, which the settlers had used in England. Construction began in late December. A disheartening setback occurred in mid-January when the thatched roof of the newly completed meeting house caught on fire. Now, fortunately, they were able to put the flames out before the whole building burned. But by the end of January, several family dwellings were partially built, but most of the pilgrims were still living in temporary quarters in the meeting house or back on the Mayflower. Captain Jones had graciously agreed to delay his return with the Mayflower to England. He knew that the settlers needed its protection. Perhaps the pilgrims had felt that the worst was over when they finally set foot on the solid ground again, but their relief was only momentary. Though they were hard workers, they couldn't build their dwellings quickly enough, and they could only endure the harsh winter weather without ill effect for so long. So as the weeks went by, the weather grew worse. In the coldest stretch of the winter, after many had suffered long, with head colds and flu-like illness swept through the colony. This disease that they called the general sickness had made much of the community desperately ill. Coughing and gasping for breath, most of the settlers were unable to leave their beds. In fact, few were spared. William Bradford, Governor Carver, and other leaders fell sick, too. During the worst of the epidemic, on a given day, only 6 or 7 out of 100 colonists might be strong enough to help tend the sick. The pilgrims began to die in alarming numbers, often 2 or 3 a day. The men strong enough to work carried the bodies out for burial at night. See, this was a tactic to hide the worsening situation in the colony from the Indians who might be spying from the woods. They didn't want the Indians to know that they were having fewer and fewer settlers in the colony. One of the men who remained healthy and tirelessly helped the others was a military leader, Captain Miles Standish. Even after his own wife, Rose, died on January 21st, Standish continued to serve others faithfully. The epidemic also struck the soldiers on board the Mayflower. Those pilgrims still on their feet ministered to the sick soldiers too, prompting one of the soldiers, a man who had ridiculed and cursed the God-fearing passengers during the sea crossing, to say, quote, "I now see you show your love like Christians indeed one to another, but we let one another lie and die like dogs," end of quote. What a change. What an observation. February brought the worst of the weather and the sickness. Freezing rains pounded the crude buildings, stripping much of the clay from the cracks between the boards and allowing the wailing cold wind to penetrate the houses. Both the sick and the healthy struggled to stay warm. 17 persons died during the month. Now, Indians were sighted on several occasions. Since the intentions of the native people were unknown, the colonists were very fearful. But under the leadership of Captain Standish, the men who were not too ill practiced military drills and shared guard duty at night. Hope began to grow again as temperatures rose slightly in early March. A few families began preparations for planting their crops. But the most memorable event in March, perhaps of the whole winter, was the arrival on March 16th of a single, nearly naked Indian brave. Unlike other Indians who ran away when confronted, this man strode bravely to the door of the meeting house and, to the surprise of all, cried out, "Welcome," in English. Stunned by his boldness and use of English, yet still wary of his intentions, the pilgrims hesitantly invited him in, offered him a plate of food and drink. The Indian ate and drank enthusiastically. After his meal, the Indian informed his host that he knew English food and customs through contacts with English fishermen. The settlers learned that his name was Samoset. He was the chief of the Algonquins, and his home tribe was farther up the coast to the north in what is now Maine. He said the Indians, who had inhabited this area earlier, had been a very large Indian tribe who had murdered every white man who had ever landed in their territory. But 4 years before the pilgrims arrived, the tribe suffered a mysterious plague, and everyone died. Neighboring tribes were so surprised by the tribe's misfortune and total demise that they avoided the area, fearing that they too would be killed by a plague. So as a result, no one lived on the land and no one owned it. It was another example of God's remarkable provision for the pilgrims. So Samoset went on to explain about the other Indian tribes in the surrounding area. The nearest Indians lived about 50 miles south of Plymouth. They were the Wampanoags, which meant people of the dawn. They were a friendly tribe headed by their chief, Massasoit. With Samoset's help, the pilgrims planned to make contact with braves from the Wampanoags to trade for animal skins. And near the end of March, with the weather improving and the worst of the influenza outbreak over, the surviving pilgrims assessed their winter losses. Several entire families had perished with the epidemic. 15 of the 19 women were dead, and only 4 couples had both spouses survived. The children had fared the best. Of 10 girls, 9 survived. Only 8 of 23 boys died. Nearly half of those who had arrived on the Mayflower now lay in the shallow graves dug on the windswept hill beside the sea. But yet, they still had Thanksgiving. They still were people of the book. Now, with the days lengthening and the temperatures warming, the pilgrims turned their attention to planting the crops desperately needed if they were to survive a second winter in America. But they were interrupted by the reappearance of their new friend, Samoset, who arrived at the settlement with 5 Indians. Though the pilgrims didn't know it at the time, one of these Indians would play perhaps the largest role in the survival of New England. Bradford wrote of him that he was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. His name was Squanto. Squanto also spoke English because years earlier he had been captured by a treacherous sea captain, taken to Europe as a slave. Since Squanto had been away when the plague wiped out his tribe, he was the lone surviving Indian from the Plymouth area. He'd been back in his native land for only 6 months. But because Squanto's English was quite good, he was asked to take the role of lead translator when the pilgrims met Massasoit. Within a week, a meeting was arranged where gifts were exchanged, a pipe smoked, and an agreement reaching the guaranteed peace between the pilgrims and this Indian tribe. In fact, this peace pact would last for 50 years. And as the days passed, both Indians and pilgrims met frequently in the nearby woods without incident. The pilgrims rested more easily. Now, Squanto stayed on in Plymouth and adopted these families as his own, never leaving them until he died. It was clear they needed his help and his invaluable practical knowledge. He showed the pilgrims how to catch eels and fish at the river to use as fertilizer for their planting of corn. This crop would save their lives in the winter to come. He taught them how to plant pumpkins and tap the maple trees for syrup and for their economic benefit, he introduced them to the trapping beaver for their pelts. This skill would be very important for their future survival. And so in early April, Captain Jones decided it was time to sail the Mayflower back home to England. With the spring sunshine restoring the health of the colonists, he felt it was now safe to leave. Even after all the hardships and many deaths, every pilgrim in the colony elected to stay in Plymouth rather than return to their homeland. With increasing hours of daylight and recovered strength, everybody in the colony soon enjoyed a pleasing weekly rhythm of work and worship. 6 days, the pilgrims tilled and hunted and fished, mended and built and cooked and washed. The only break in the routine every week was on Sunday, when the group faithfully observed the Sabbath. On this day, ordinary work clothes were exchanged for more colorful attire. And unlike the somberly clothed Puritans, who in the years to come would settle further to the north, the Plymouth colonists wore brightly colored dresses, suits, and hats. In garments of blue and red and green and violet and yellow, the congregation sang and prayed and listened to a rousing sermon by their elder, William Brewster. Springtime turned the thoughts of some away from the grief of lost husbands and wives to new love. In fact, the first remarriage occurred in May between two of the widowed. The wedding reception gave everybody an opportunity to laugh and sing and enjoy some special foods and drinks. Another potential romance turned tragic as two young men, both named Edward, fell in love with a beautiful 15-year-old girl named Constance. The rivalry became so intense that the two suitors decided a duel was the only way to decide who should win the girl. Well, the two Edwards met on the beach, began to fight with daggers and swords. Both drew blood, but their shouts alerted other colonists. Several men came running and separated the two before either of them were killed. But apparently, Constance was unimpressed. She chose not to marry either one of them. In August, during some conflict among Indian tribes, the friend of the pilgrim, Squanto, was taken hostage and threatened with death. So under the leadership of Miles Standish, an armed detail left Plymouth to rescue him. In the middle of the night, the pilgrims burst into the village where Squanto was a hostage. After a brief fight, in which several Indian braves suffered sword wounds, Squanto was rescued unharmed. This aggressive military action made such an impression on all the area tribes that within days, new peace treaties were agreed by all the parties. God had shown the Indians that he was on their side. You know, folks, when you realize the difficulties that these folks were going through, trying to build homes and plant crops and everything else, but yet nothing kept them from going to church. I wonder, as we close this broadcast today, what is it that we accept as excuses for not making it to church? They're usually pretty puny excuses, aren't they? Why don't you just be challenged by these pilgrims and determine in your heart and mind, I'm going to be in God's house Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, because that's what makes my week strong. Until the next time, may the Lord bless you in a fantastic way.